the corner of the table along with a pack of cigarettes easily within Deshawn's reach. Deshawn walked over to the table and picked up the lighter. He ignited it easily. The first thing he lit was the sleeping bag tag. It quickly caught on fire. He watched what he had done. Soon the whole sleeping bag was on fire. At first the fire sounded like a whisper, not loud enough to be heard by Sadie in the kitchen. But it took on a quiet strength. Deshawn didn't understand what was happening, though he understood that it was something bigger than himself. At first, he did not move, transfixed by what was happening. When the seat cushions of the couch caught fire, he realized that he was going to be in trouble. He needed to tell somebody. He ran toward the doorway that led to the kitchen. "Grandma!" he yelled. Sadie came out of the kitchen and saw the growing fire. She snatched Deshawn up into her arms. By now the flames had spread from the sofa to the carpet, and they were heading toward the curtains. Intense heat filled the room. She thought it was too late to try to stop the fire, and that the best hope was to get Deshawn out of the house and to safety. In a moment, Sadie had to make a critical decision. From where she was standing, she had two possible exits. One was a back door through the kitchen, in the opposite direction of the fire. The other option was the front door, which would have been within Sadie's line of sight, as she surveyed the fire in the living room. Choosing the front door would require her to walk quickly through the burning room and avoid the sofa. That exit would also lead her and Deshawn out to the street, where they could call for help. Sadie chose the front door. She lowered her head and walked through the living room with Deshawn smothered in her arms. When she arrived at the door, though, she could not get it open. The bolt was stuck. Her hands were nervous and fumbling, and she decided that they would need to try the back door after all, walking back again through the burning room, which had grown even hotter in the moments she had spent at the front door. Sadie turned around, holding Deshawn as close as she could to her, and entered the burning living room once again. Then Sadie tripped. The grandmother and grandson fell face forward, surrounded by flames and unable to flee the rising heat. Sadie could not get up. Instead, she laid her body on top of her grandson and held him close. Deshawn remembers Sadie smothering his tiny body with her own. After that, he remembers nothing. It was there, less than 10 feet from safety, that firefighters would find them both when they broke down the front door. The sheriff pulled into the parking lot at Hardee's. The lights on the top of his car were flashing. When he walked into the restaurant, the employee who had taken his call and handed the phone to Karen was rubbing Karen's shoulder, trying to console her. "Are you Karen Walker?" the sheriff asked. Karen said yes. He had assumed she was married and that she had taken Robert Walker's last name. The sheriff said he'd drive Karen to the hospital. She wanted to know what had happened, and yet she was afraid to know. Once Karen was in the car, the sheriff said, "I'm not going to break any laws, but I'm going to get you there as quickly as I can." He turned on his lights and siren. There had been a fire at Sadie Walker's house, the sheriff said, and Sadie had been burned very critically, and Deshawn had also been burned. Karen took her face in her hands and said, "No, no, no." She hoped that this was a case of mistaken identity. St. Mary's Hospital was at Lake Drive and North Avenue, a 20-minute drive away. When the sheriff arrived with Karen, there were media cameras in the parking lot. Karen saw Deshawn's father, Robert Walker, standing outside the emergency room entrance. She stepped out of the car, and he bear-hugged her. And he said in her ear, "You've got to listen to these people." It wasn't clear to Karen to whom he was referring. "Where is my son?" Karen said. "Show me my son, and I will listen to these people." Inside, the medical staff tried to prepare her for the sight of her son. She understood little of it. She asked to be taken to him right away. She remembers medical staff fitting her with a gown, a face mask, and a plastic hair cap. In a small room at the end of a long hallway was a boy, partially covered in white sterile sheets, with medical professionals working all around him. He was connected to IVs, which were pumping fluid into his charred body. Karen and Deshelle had recently given Boo Boo black braids. All of this boy's hair had melted, except for the tail end of some braids at the very back of his head. The boy's head was pink. The skin on his neck and his upper chest had dark pink bubbles. She looked at his hands. His fingers were stubs. They looked like wax birthday candles that had melted part of the way down. The doctors estimated that he had second and third degree burns over a third of his body. "This is not my son," Karen told herself. "They have taken away my son and replaced him." Karen felt overwhelmed by a sense of guilt. She felt selfish and inadequate for the faults of her past life. She felt powerless to go back and correct what had happened. She wanted to believe that this was not him. Yet, as she stood by the boy's side, one of her tears dropped onto his burned hand. And for a moment, the boy's eyelids opened up. Karen recognized Deshaun's eyes. And she passed out on the emergency room floor. Across town that morning, Deshaun's older sister, Deshelle Parker, then 11, was having lunch at John Muir Middle School. It was chicken patty day. Deshelle really liked chicken patties, and she was looking forward to her chance to eat. Before she could sit down, however, an administrator called her out of the lunchroom and took her to an upstairs office. An older cousin of hers, whom she rarely saw, was there. The cousin said that Deshelle would have to leave with her. As Deshelle exited the office with her cousin, she felt everyone in the office look at her as if she were someone solemn and important. Deshelle realized that this was strange, this was different. She got into a car that her aunt Cynthia, Karen's sister, was driving. "Your brother has been in an accident," Cynthia said. "He's been in a fire." Deshelle didn't understand. Cynthia stopped to fill the car with gas on the way, and Deshelle just kept thinking, "Get me there. Let me see him." The car finally arrived at Milwaukee's Children's Hospital, where Deshaun had now been transferred, and Deshelle soon saw her mother in a waiting room. Karen had, by that time, revived. Dark streams lay on her face where the tears had run. Deshelle started crying, too. She was emotional because everyone around her was emotional. She wanted to see her brother, but her mother wouldn't let her. Deshelle got angry at her mother and started yelling at her. "If it wasn't for me," Deshelle said, "he wouldn't be here." Before Deshaun was born, she had asked her mother for a sibling. When he arrived, she felt it to be a direct result of her request. "This is your baby," Karen told her. By this reasoning, Deshelle now felt that the reason that Deshaun was suffering was because she had wanted a brother. She felt that the reason that her mother was so distraught was because she had wanted a brother. This was her fault. "Let me see him," Deshelle said. "I want to see him now." Karen kept saying no. She didn't want Deshelle to experience the shock that she had felt. Before the night was over, though, Karen relented. She walked with Deshelle back to Deshaun's room in the intensive care unit. Deshelle looked at Deshaun's swollen pink head and his arms wrapped in bloody white bandages. "That's not my brother," Deshelle said. "That's not him." Deshelle turned away, and she walked with her mother back into the waiting room. There she sat and thought about her reaction. Hours later, she told her mother that she wanted to go back to his bed again. "From then on, I was strong," Deshelle said. "And I've been strong for him since." Sadie Walker died on the afternoon of the fire at St. Mary's Hospital. Her body had protected most of Deshaun's back from burns. In her hospital bed, she woke briefly several hours before the fire and said, "Where's Boo?" Her family said that Boo had been moved to Children's Hospital. Sadie took a deep breath and passed away. Deshaun stayed in a coma for almost a month. His mother kept vigil constantly by his bedside. On the day that he awoke, Karen was sitting next to Deshaun when she heard her son's familiar voice saying, "Ice. Ice." The nurses had tied his arms to the bed so that he wouldn't accidentally fall out. Karen jumped up and ran into the hallway of the hospital saying, "He's woke! He's woke!" The nurses dressed Karen in a gown, and they untied Deshaun. For the first time since the accident, Karen held her son in her arms. She put ice to his lips, and he tried to suck it out of her hand. Deshaun then said, "Cell. Where's Cell?" Deshaun always said Cell when he was trying to say D-shell, because he had trouble with the H. Deshaun had woken up on her 12th birthday. Deshaun was quickly brought to the hospital to see him. It had been very difficult to celebrate a birthday, needless to say, Deshaun later told me, but at the same time to have my brother wake up and ask for me, it was probably one of the greatest gifts as well. By the time that Deshaun arrived at my place 3 years later, he had endured dozens of skin grafts and surgeries. The doctors had made him wear plastic masks to protect his face and splints to protect his arms. They put pins in what was left of his fingers to straighten them out, in the hopes he would regain some ability to grasp. His hair had begun to regrow on the back of his head, but not on the front. It gave the impression of an older man with hair loss, and other children had teased him about being bald. Deshaun was very aware of people's reactions to her brother and very protective of him. Once, Deshaun had attacked a boy less than half her age in the park when she saw him kicking sand on her brother. Deshaun had let his mother know that he was not happy about leaving their old house, which he liked. It was painted white, and he called it the White House. He liked living in a place called the White House. He had mixed feelings on the yellow duplex, and he didn't understand why his mother had moved. Deshaun also felt that their new living situation was a definite step backward. Deshaun went to the local elementary school, but after he came home, and on the weekends, he spent much of his free time in the greenhouses. The florists who previously owned the facility had left behind some of their plants, and I hadn't had time to clear those old plants out. In the second greenhouse behind the store, there was a cactus under a table. Of all the plants in the facility, Deshaun took a keen interest in that cactus. He moved it to another table so that it could see more sun, and so that he could visit it more easily. He sometimes sat by it, and I wondered what he saw in it. Cacti are what botanists call xerophytes, plants that have mechanisms for storing water that allow them to survive long dry spells. I hoped that this cactus reminded him of his own resilience. In those early months at my greenhouses, Deshaun rarely said a word to me, but he watched me as I worked. He also began to follow me into the kitchen behind the florist shop where I liked to cook. I prepared southern dishes like mustard greens, turnips, collards, okra, fried chicken, and fish. Deshaun sat down on his small stool and observed me silently. When I needed a spatula or a ladle, I asked him to fetch it for me, and he did so dutifully. I knew many recipes from my mother. Deshaun took in each step of the process. I let him test food as it was done. His eyes would let me know if he approved or not. For all she faced, Karen managed to hold down steady work and raise her two kids. At the time of Deshaun's fire, she didn't understand why her son was being punished at a time when she was trying to keep her life straight. In the neighborhood of my market, the Parkers were not the only family facing daunting challenges. Milwaukee was one of the last stops in the Great Migration. The city's black population grew from 7,500 in 1930 to more than 105,000 in 1970. During the Second World War, Milwaukee became a hub for industrial manufacturing and the headquarters for a bomb maker, the A.O. Smith Corporation. Many black people who had left Alabama or Mississippi were able to find well-paying, stable work there. They joined labor unions and even bought homes. During the 1970s, though, the city began to see an erosion of its manufacturing industries, a trend that was happening across the Midwest. Union jobs declined and opportunities diminished. The cohesion of African-American families and communities suffered in the wake of job losses. Watching Deshaun, I began to think of how my greenhouses could be more than just a farm stand. For him and for others, My facility could be a safe place, as Karen saw it. A third of the people in the neighborhood were living below the federal poverty level. The community was 97% black. Almost half of the households were headed by a single parent. About half of the men did not have legitimate work. The children often had no place to go after school. I wasn't sure what impact I could really have with a roadside vegetable stand, yet I wanted to do what I could. There is a useful parable about a man who comes upon a sparrow along the edge of a road. The sparrow is lying on its back with its feet sticking upward. The man asks the sparrow what it is doing. "I heard that the sky is falling," the bird replies, "and I want to hold it up." The man laughs at the bird. "You believe that you can hold up the whole sky?" "No," the bird says. "But one does what one can." During the first spring and summer, I was selling enough produce to cover my basic expenses. As the Milwaukee winter arrived, though, I began having difficulty paying my bills. An old boiler that I inherited was the market's only source of heat. It sputtered loudly throughout the day. As the weather became colder in the evenings, it began to break down almost every night at about 10 or 11 p.m. I had to go into the boiler room and try to restart it. You could hear the large volumes of gas being sucked into it. The first winter, my gas bill became as high as $7,000 a month. I needed a new boiler, but I was undercapitalized, and I couldn't afford one. I did everything I could to finance my operation that winter. I drove 2.5 hours northwest of Milwaukee to Coloma, Wisconsin, and picked up hundreds of white pine Christmas trees that I sold outside my greenhouses in December. I partnered with a man who had a southern food store in Kenosha, Wisconsin. He drove down to Mississippi and Alabama with a big truck and shared with me the produce he bought there. I paid an extra charge for the delivery, which I passed on, reluctantly, to my customers. I soon realized that I would have trouble paying Karen, Deschelle, and the few other young people from the neighborhood who worked at my stand. I went back to the First Star Bank in the fall of 1994, and I said that I needed $30,000. I explained that bedding plants, trays of ornamental perennials and annuals, had become a large part of my spring income. I didn't have the money to buy the seed to create these trays, which I grew in the second greenhouse from the road, and my business would suffer if I didn't have these trays ready by early spring. The bank approved my first loan based on my past credit rating. When I came back to them only a year and a half later, they were much more skeptical. The banker who took my application said that he needed to see a business plan and how I was going to make my business economically viable. I didn't have anyone to do that, and the bank said they could provide somebody. It would take 6 months to come up with the plan, they said. But by that time, I would need to have the bedding trays prepared. Gas and electric companies began sending representatives to our greenhouses to ask for overdue payments. They often threatened to cut us off. Once, Karen remembers writing a check for $2,000 from her personal account for our electric bill, knowing that she did not have that money in the bank. When I arrived at work, she told me that I needed to cover her check. I told her I didn't have the money. Karen's check bounced, and the electric company came the next week to turn the lights off. I was able to get them turned back on a few days later. My willingness to live so close to the margin put great stress on my wife. She had grown up on the top floor of her family's restaurant, and as an adult, she had wanted to keep her personal and business lives separate. I was making that impossible. Will's Roadside barely survived that winter. The power companies began taking only cash from me because they didn't trust my checks. I asked Karen if I could temporarily suspend paying her a regular salary. Karen agreed to make this sacrifice. I paid her when I could. I was also paying my mortgage weeks late. Because of First Star's reluctance to provide an additional loan, I ultimately wasn't able to buy the amount of seed I needed for the spring bedding plants. I did what I could manage, but I could only prepare a fraction of the trays that I knew I could sell. When the spring of 1995 came, I wasn't sure how I was going to survive another year. That spring, my friend Lynn Hildenbrand told me about a group of young city children at a nearby YWCA who wanted to build a garden. Lynn's boss served with me on the Board of Hunger Task Force, a local charity. The children in Lynn's project were part of a Young Sisters and Brothers leadership program, and they wanted to grow enough food to sell at a market. She asked if I could be an advisor. I drove down to the YWCA facility and saw that the children only had 2 8-by-8-foot plots available to grow in. I knew right away that this would not be enough space for them to raise food to sell. I had long been thinking about how to use the acre and a half of empty land behind my greenhouses. It was overgrown with tall weeds, which suggested to me that the land was fertile. I told Lynn that I would be glad to donate this land for the students' summer project. They decided to come. I cleared the land all the way to the back fence and tilled up the soil. With my guidance, the group of 10 children and teens planted collards, 100 tomato and bean plants, and about 150 peppers, including jalapenos and cayenne. When we transplanted seedlings into the soil, the children weren't sure at first what to do with them. Green side up, I told them. Roots go in the ground. Groundhogs soon wandered over from the nearby Army Reserve site and devoured all of the children's bean plants and collard greens. The young people were upset at first, but I told them that being a good gardener required adaptation and perseverance, lessons that I was still learning. We planted more tomato plants together where the beans had been. I believe that this quality of grit, the ability to withstand setbacks and disappointments, is more important to teach children than any facts we can cram into their heads. I enjoyed this work with kids even more than I'd anticipated. Most of the young people came from low-income neighborhoods, and none of them had any prior experience with agriculture. I carried water for them, answered questions, taught them how to seed, and planted alongside of them. A reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel showed up in early August and wrote an article about the children's work. One of the teens in the program was an earnest boy with the improbable name of Ronnie Turnipseed, who was 13. We learned how to plant right, how to put down fertilizer, and we're looking forward to eating the crops, too, he told the reporter. Most kids don't get to work with the soil and learn to grow things that can mean self-sufficiency, I was quoted as saying. This is a way for young people to learn that in hard times they can grow their own good, nutritious food. The same summer, I also started loading up my truck with vegetables on weekdays and driving to vacant lots in neighborhoods near me. I wanted to try to bring fresh food directly to people who had no other access to it. I realized some people might be willing to come to these markets who might not be willing to come by my roadside stand. At an empty lot in the West End, I worked with a local development committee, and they set up a booth to sell my produce on Thursdays. I sold out of the back of my truck at 40th Street and Florist Avenue on Tuesdays and on Wednesdays. I partnered with a community center next to the West Lawn Housing Project. My sales were modest at these stands, but I hoped to grow these markets as I built relationships in these communities. While I struggled financially, Karen's daughter, Deschelle, who was now almost 17, grew more embittered about her situation. I had known her since she was a young girl and before she was a teen. She had helped me at Sunday farmers markets, but since her mother's move, Deschelle was being asked to do much more. She was expected to work on weekends and often on school days, running the cash register in the store, loading and unloading trucks, rotating groceries, talking to the customers. Her house was right next door, and Deschelle felt like she could never escape from her mother's watchful eye. When her mother told her that I could not pay her for a while, Deschelle became quietly angry. She wanted to work at Kmart or JCPenney or any store at the mall. She wanted to visit with her friends and not be the girl who worked at the farm stand. She felt like the expectations on her were higher than on anybody else. Deschelle also heard complaints about me in the store. During the first year, more members of the local community began visiting the market for the first time. Many of the older residents expressed their appreciation to me. They said they were happy to have access to foods they had known as children in the South, butter beans, okra, and corn. Some of the residents, though, walked in and walked out without buying anything. They voiced complaints to Deschelle. How can a black man be selling food at these prices? These prices are why I don't eat this food. This is why we go to the white person. I was also working with many white farmers, which led to resentment. He is a black man, and he should employ only black people. I thought these accusations weren't fair. My prices were the same as those at a typical Milwaukee supermarket. I wanted the prices to be lower. but to keep paying my mortgage on the property, I couldn't sell products for less than they cost me. I wanted to work with more black farmers, too, but the reality was that there were only 24 of them in the whole of Wisconsin. I was building relationships with black farmers in the South, but that would take time. I tried other things to show I was sensitive to the criticism. I ran specials on greens, and I charged $1 for 3 pounds, hoping that these lost leaders would attract more local residents. During my years selling my produce at other farmers' markets, I sometimes saw black customers go to a white farmer in the stall next to me, even though I knew my produce looked better and cost the same. This was not typical, but it happened. I felt it was the result of internal racism. People had become so accustomed to thinking of the white man as superior, it was a mindset they hadn't been able to shake. It was as if they didn't want to see me get a big head. I didn't have a big head now. I was often weeks behind with my mortgage payment. I had allowed Karen to bounce her own checks. I was unable to pay the people who had been most loyal to me, though I did not admit it to anyone. I wondered if I had made a big mistake. Around this time, a black friend asked me about my farming habit. "Why do you want to do that slave's work?" he said. It was a good question. I did not have an easy reply. To my friend, the profession was tainted with the historical legacy of slavery and economic hardship. In returning to farming, I was swimming against a current that had carried my family and millions of other black people out of South Carolina and into northern cities. But my passion for farming had also been nourished in part by lingering impressions left from my childhood. The close observation of my parents and of a kindly older woman who owned the land where we lived, and their shared interest in plants and horticulture. I was a reluctant inheritor of my agricultural history. It was a past that I spent most of my young life trying to escape. Get started. A lot of times we have an idea of something we'd really like to do, but we wait for the perfect moment to begin. I'm here to tell you that there is no perfect moment. If I had waited for a perfect time to start Will's Roadside Farm Market, I would have never begun. One of the most important pieces of advice that I give anyone wanting to start a garden is a simple one. Get started. If you're beginning a garden for the first time, for instance, it's probably going to be several years before you get halfway good at growing anything. You're going to learn a lot in that process. Get started. You can sit around and talk for the next 10 years. Talk is cheap. Start small and then move along the long path toward your goal. You're going to have missteps and you're going to make mistakes. When I opened Will's Roadside, I wasn't able to have all my produce be organic. Some of it was conventionally grown from farms I partnered with in the South. But I also knew that a community that did not have access to fresh apples suddenly had them. Providing fresh fruit to that community was one early step along a path. I would work in these years to come to have as much of my food be organic as possible, though I am still not as far along as I want to be. All big things are created by a slow and steady accumulation of small, stumbling steps. Idealism can sometimes lead to inaction. We are so afraid of doing something imperfectly that we don't do anything at all. We need to get into action. Now is not a time for us just to talk. Your work may start out a little raggedy, but if you get started, it will get better. Part 1. Roots. Black Flight. So much of my early adult life was spent in restless seeking. As a professional basketball player, as a discotheque manager, as a Kentucky Fried Chicken executive, and Procter & Gamble salesman. Looking back, I now see how all of these experiences helped form my character. It has been said that every moment and every event of a man's life plants something in his soul. I understand now how I was influenced in my youth by seeds that others planted in me. Many of them took root only decades later. My return to farming was unlikely. My story begins before I was born, in the fields of western South Carolina. A generation before I opened my stand, my mother, Willie Mae Kenner, came up out of South Carolina with her heart full of yearning. She was driven by contradictory longings that she later imparted to me. We both loved raising food and feeding others, but we craved independence and wanted to do it on our own terms. We felt at peace on the land, but recognized the potential of cities and colleges to provide a better future for our children. The family that my mother, Willie Mae, left by train in South Carolina was poor, and yet for many years they were capably poor. They supported one another through mutual cooperation, feeding one another, coming to one another's financial aid when needed, and helping to raise one another's children. My mother's brother, Benny, the oldest of my uncles, was a great believer in family. Whenever anybody did anything, good or bad, he never appeared surprised. He nodded his head and said, "What did you expect? Look where they came from." My mother's family was anchored by Rosa Belle Green, my maternal grandmother. She had married a hulking man named Henry Rayford, who was part black and part Chickasaw. The Chickasaws, a Native American tribe, enslaved African Americans for decades, even after the end of the Civil War. As the product of a biracial pairing, Henry's life was evidence that historical wrongs could sometimes be reconciled. Rosa Belle bore Henry 10 children, including my mother. All of those children grew to tower over her. She and Henry and their children lived on the edge of Ridge Spring, an agricultural community with old plantations and fields of cotton and asparagus and peaches. Henry died young of a cerebral hemorrhage, and Rosa Belle was left to support her children. She later married another man her grandchildren called Mr. Ike, but the family often said that Rosa Belle carried the house by herself. She don't know how to cook little. That's another thing the family said about Rosa Belle. Every day, she needed to feed her large family. For many sharecroppers in South Carolina, the main meal was at high noon. Rosa Belle called it the big meal. It was too big to be called lunch, and too early to be called supper. The Rayford children gathered back at Rosa Belle's house after a morning of work in the fields picking cotton. Their work clothes would be damp and heavy. She was responsible for giving them strength for more work until dusk. As they picked cotton and asparagus, the family sang spirituals together. Sometimes I feel discouraged and think my work's in vain. But then the Holy Spirit revives my soul again. Rosa Belle kept her own garden adjacent to her unpainted clapboard home, and she knew how to raise everything herself. She believed in the medicinal power of herbs, and her garden included sage, mint, and horehound, a flowering plant that could be made into a tea that helped with digestion. She grew sunflowers for their seeds and for their beauty. Rosa Belle's kitchen had two wood stoves, and she would cook with both going at the same time. She started each day with breakfast, grits and meats like pork or fried chicken or steak. She kept chickens and pigs and cows. As her children had their own children, she dispatched the young ones to collect the eggs, milk the cows, and grab grapes and berries off the vines. Benny had a truck, and he would often bring his mother peaches from a field that he sharecropped, and she would turn them into a cobbler. She didn't buy things, Rosa Belle. She was an expert at make-do. She made her corn flour out of corn. She got her lard from the hog. She knew how to make lye soap to wash her clothes. She saved the bones from the hogs and chickens, and she mixed them with lye. The lye digested the bones, and she stirred the mixture and stirred it until it resembled a thick dough. She let it sit overnight and then cut hard squares of soap to be used for washing. Rosa Belle's children never lacked for food. They never went hungry, even when they were so poor in other ways. She often held picnics in the yard, especially after the slaughter of a pig, and she invited all the neighbors. It was in Rosa Belle's kitchen that my own mother learned how to cook. She also learned how the long wooden table and the dining room could bring the family together. At that table, Rosabelle's family shared stories and gossip. As times got tougher, they also shared their thoughts of leaving. The fabric that held my family to Ridge Spring began to fray during the Great Depression. One by one, my aunts and uncles left, lured by the hopes of a better life in the North. When the Civil War ended, many former slaves remained in the South because it was unclear exactly where they should go. Upon hearing word of Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, some were said to have walked to the entrance of their plantations, only to turn directly around and come back. It was unclear what freedom meant or would mean. Many who remained entered into sharecropping agreements with their former slave owners. This arrangement turned out to be the primary economic relationship of blacks and whites in the South following the war. Instead of the position of master and slave, a sharecropping agreement ostensibly changed the relationship to that of employer and employee. Sharecropping worked this way. A landowner provided land to farm and often provided the tools, a mule, a horse, hoes, seed. The sharecropper provided all the labor. At the end of the growing season, the sharecropper settled up with the landlord. The landowner sold the crop that the sharecropper harvested and then split the proceeds. The sharecropper usually got half. That's why some people called this arrangement half-cropping. In theory, this was a much better deal than slavery. In practice, though, sharecropping often became slavery under a different name. A sharecropper often needed to borrow money from the landowner in advance of the planting season, only to find himself unable to pay that debt back after they settled up. The tenant farmer and his family could soon be caught in a cycle of debt. The worst landowners would steal from sharecroppers, withholding money that they had legitimately earned at the end of the planting season. Laws in the South favored whites to such a degree that the sharecropper often had no legal right to make a claim. During the Great Depression, sharecropping became an economic chokehold for many black people. From 1929 to 1932, the worst years of the Depression, before the election of Franklin D. Roosevelt, the cash income of South Carolina farmers dropped by two-thirds. Cotton farms in South Carolina were also being ruined by the boll weevil, a quarter-inch long beetle that punctured the round boll, or outer shell, of the cotton plant with its long snout, laid its eggs inside, and decimated the fluffy contents before harvest. For a sharecropper who was already in debt, this combination of circumstances meant there was little hope to break free outside of leaving. This was the dilemma that faced Major Kenner and my mother, Willie May. For 5 years, they had grown cotton and asparagus for Joseph Calhoun Watson, Sr., a descendant of a Revolutionary War veteran who was one of the early white settlers of Ridge Spring. Watson controlled 300 acres, and he employed many of my mother's brothers. South Carolina had been the first state to secede from the Union after Abraham Lincoln was elected president, and racial unrest lingered long after the war was over. In 1926, three members of the local Lohman family were killed by a lynch mob in nearby Aiken. Many felt that the Lohmans, who were related to my own family by marriage, became targets simply because they were successful African-American farmers. They were accused of bootlegging alcohol. The local sheriff raided their home unexpectedly, and he was shot under circumstances that remain in dispute. The men who killed the Lohmans were never charged with a crime. The Watsons, however, treated my mother and Major with respect, but there were clear boundaries. None of my family was allowed to eat in Mrs. Watson's kitchen or enter through her front door. Sometimes Mrs. Watson would make food for my mother and her two boys, which she would let them eat on her front porch, but never inside. Nobody questioned these unspoken rules. Joseph Watson's son, Joe Jr., who is now in his late 80s, says he still remembers the day in 1934 when Major settled up at the end of the cotton season. Since the price of cotton was only 5 cents per pound, his father received $25 for every 500 pounds, leaving Major only $12.50. Joe Jr. had lent Major some money at the beginning of that growing season, and Major had promised to pay it back when the harvest was done. At the end of the season, Major realized he would never be able to get ahead. His hands were cracked and raw from the picking season. Major had to pick about 50 bolls for every penny he earned. or about 64,800 bowls, to earn $12.50. When he settled, Joe Jr. said, "Major looked around," and he walked off shaking his head. He was worse off than when he started. Joe Jr. now runs a shop in Ridge Spring called the Nut House, where he sells pecans. The population of Ridge Spring is 790, roughly the same that it was at the start of the Great Depression. The graveyards there are thicker with souls than the streets of the living. "There were some wonderful people who lived around here," Joe said recently. "I think we had the best people that lived almost anywhere, white and black. And we lost lots and lots of outstanding black people because there was no money. They were depending on the white man for the money for the job, and there wasn't any money." One by one they left. When the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor in 1941, Willie Mae's brothers were eager to fight the war. Of her seven brothers, three entered the army, and two joined the Marines. In the armed services, my mother's brothers were suddenly earning $50 to $70 a month. They all sent Rosa Belle money while they were away. Rosa Belle built a new two-story brick and clapboard house, hoping she could reunite her family in a stronger position after the war ended. One of her sons came back shell-shocked. Her sixth child, Calvin, lost his leg. Everybody else came back whole. But once they had become used to earning a good income, it was hard for them even to consider picking cotton again. They looked north. They took trains, cars, buses to New York and New Jersey. One found a job at E.J. Corvette's, the retail giant. Another went into the demolition business. Another took a job as a hospital attendant. They had to learn new skills and come to terms with the fact that the skills they had were worth about as much to them as a heavy bag of depression cotton. Most of them were glad to be gone. Their children would often pretend the family had never come from South Carolina. They saw no good in being associated with sharecropping. "There was a long time when I wouldn't even talk about being from the South," one of my cousins said. "I saw my past as a stigma. People would say, 'Where are you from?' I would say, 'Long Island.'" My father, O.W. Allen, the seventh of 12 children, knew my mother in Ridge Spring before she left. He was a broad-shouldered man, who usually dressed in overalls and a white cotton shirt. He began working in the fields after the third grade, typically the last grade of education offered then for black people in his county, and he was illiterate. O.W. was good, though, at reading things besides words. When hunting squirrels to eat, he could look at the branches of a river birch tree and tell you by the bend of the branches and the torque of the leaves if a squirrel had recently been there. He loved to fish, and he knew how to read the surface of a river and tell you when the cod would bite and when they wouldn't. He knew how to build things like chicken coops and rock walls and how to make moonshine. How well my father and mother knew each other in South Carolina is unclear. O.W. was a sharecropper who had married young and also had two children. He told me that one day when he was working in the field, he realized there was no future for him in the South. "I dropped my plow and I left," he said. He moved his family to the same small African-American community near Washington, D.C., that Major Kinner and Willie Mae called home. Soon after the end of the Second World War, my mother and father, the aspiring schoolteacher, and a man who admired her but couldn't sign his own name, left their spouses and married each other. In 1947, they had a son named Joe. On February 8, 1949, they had a son they named Will. The Virtue of Making Do. One lesson I take from my grandmother Rosabelle's life is the virtue of making do. She didn't have the money to buy irrigation systems or greenhouses or chemical fertilizer. She was a conservationist by necessity. She learned how to improve her soil by gathering leaves and animal waste and spreading it in her garden. She learned to rotate her crops so that the nutrients in the soil would not be depleted. She made mistakes and refined her practices year by year. Her knowledge was deeply rooted in generations of experience. Many of the techniques my grandmother used were advocated by George Washington Carver, the famous black agriculturalist. Carver is a personal hero of mine. He once recalled arriving for a new teaching job at Tuskegee Institute and finding few resources at his disposal. "I went to the trash pile," Carver wrote, "and started my laboratory with bottles, old fruit jars, and any other thing I found I could use." Carver was constantly looking for ways to solve problems from existing resources. In 1916, he published How to Grow the Peanut in 105 Ways of Preparing It for Human Consumption. One of those new uses was peanut butter. In the early 20th century, many southern black farmers lacked adequate protein in their diets. By championing the peanut, Carver offered a solution that was accessible to anyone, regardless of his or her means. Next time you encounter a problem, try to ask yourself this question: how can I fix this with the resources that I have? There is a deep satisfaction in learning how to make do. Beginning. I started growing and selling food, by necessity, before I was 10 years old. The work came during summer breaks in the 1950s from Rock Terrace Elementary, an all-black school in Rockville, Maryland. I remember how my brothers and I spent some weekend mornings shelling Ford Hook lima beans that we had grown. Lima beans can have a tough pod to crack. First you have to string them, and then squeeze the pod at the crease to open it up. Then you clear the beans with your fingers. Do this a few hundred times and your hands start to ache, and for a young person, existential questions can arise. When I was a boy, the laws of the Jim Crow era were starting to be dismantled. In the May of 1954, the Supreme Court decided Brown v. Board of Education, ruling that it was unconstitutional to have separate schools for blacks and whites. Joe and I returned that fall to Rock Terrace anyway. There were 57 white schools and nearly 3,000 black students in Montgomery County, Maryland, and it took the school board a while to figure out how to integrate. Although our county was once home to the former slave who inspired Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, we were one of the few black families living in our part of Rockville. Joe, my younger brother Tommy, born in 1953, and my parents and I lived in a small wooden house. It sat at the end of a narrow dirt driveway flanked by oak trees. We lived less than 50 feet from a larger house owned by Mrs. Ethelwyn Frank, the Canadian-born widow of a scientist for the U.S. Public Health Service. Unknown to me at the time, one of the founders of the environmental movement, Rachel Carson, had recently moved into a home only a few miles away from Mrs. Frank. My mother, who left South Carolina with such hope, had found work as Mrs. Frank's domestic help. With our assistance, my mother and father grew food, cooked meals, and cleaned house for Mrs. Frank. In exchange for these services, we were given a place to live and have our own large garden. My father also worked odd jobs in construction to supplement his income. My parents had no inheritance. We made a little extra money by selling the surplus food we grew. After my mother, brothers, and I had shelled lima beans, we sometimes placed them carefully in quart containers. Then we stacked the containers neatly into a red radio flyer wagon that my younger brother Tommy pulled down our long driveway on sales runs. At the driveway's end, as the years passed, Tommy looked across a two-lane road toward a planned community and a vision of how America was changing. Before I was a teenager, a new Montrose subdivision took the place of what had been a dense wood. It was made up of small ramblers and split-level homes, built on less than a quarter acre. The streets were paved. The lawns of straw and dirt were seeded, and they changed over the years from brown to green. New cars came to rest in many of the driveways. It was a period of rapid change. It was the era of Eisenhower's interstate highway system, the growth of the commuter suburb, and of a new professional class. In the early 20th century, more than 90% of the people living in Montgomery County made their living from agriculture. The fertile soil of the region produced corn, wheat, oats, and tobacco. That way of life began to disappear as the county's population doubled from 1946 to 1950. The area was becoming a commuter suburb for the federal employees in Washington, D.C. Farmers began to sell their land to developers who built neighborhoods as densely packed as a honeycomb. The streets of these new subdivisions were named after the things they were replacing: Green Pasture Drive, Farm Pond Lane. Families who remained on farms were finding that their products sold for less. The way people ate was changing. Frozen food output grew fivefold in the decade from 1945 to 1955 as freezer compartments became regular features of refrigerators. Technologies that were originally designed to provide food for soldiers at war, canning, dehydration, condensing milk, now produced food for American families. A growing urban population created an increased demand for processed foods. In Southern California, the fast food industry was being born. In 1954, a milkshake mixer salesman named Ray Kroc visited Dick and Mac McDonald's hamburger restaurant in San Bernardino, California, and soon began putting McDonald's franchises at highway intersections all across the country. Tommy often walked door-to-door in the Montrose subdivision with our produce. We joked that Joe and I were the growers and Tommy was our salesman. On occasion, Joe and I made our own sales trips. I smiled nicely and handed over the produce if a customer made a purchase. I did not feel comfortable making the sales pitch. I was shy and generally didn't say a word. Tommy was cute and good at selling. He always did well. His work was made easier by the fact that our lima beans were beautiful, plump and buttery. It was difficult for the residents to turn down a polite and well-intentioned boy selling fresh vegetables. He came home with his radio flyer empty and with quarters jangling in his pockets. I might have felt proud of our shared accomplishment. Instead, I felt my difference. I wanted to live on a paved road, not a dirt one. I wanted to buy food that other people grew, not grow food that other people ate. Despite my mother's dreams of teaching, she was not able to find a way. The hopes that drew her from South Carolina did not match the circumstances in which she landed. Her opportunities were so limited that the security she found at Mrs. Frank's property was its own kind of success. When Willie Mae first arrived in Washington, Major Kinner had taken her to live in Kingar, an African-American community consisting of 6 dirt roads sandwiched between Kensington and Garrett Park, Maryland. During the Great Migration, Kingar became a kind of way station for African-Americans who left the South and were trying to establish themselves in Washington, D.C. No blacks had lived there until 1905, when 2 African-Americans purchased land. The whites who lived nearby soon rushed to sell their property. Throughout the North, other communities experienced similar white flight as black people arrived in greater numbers. Though 10 miles from the White House, Kingar was a world away. The conditions reflected the persistence of segregation even for those black people who had left the South. The community was hemmed in by the Metropolitan Branch of the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. With a white community on the other side, Kingar was literally across the tracks. Most of the homes were one-story wooden structures, and my family moved to a 3-room house they shared with 2 other families. There would not be running water or a sewage system in Kingar until the early 1950s. A local women's community club, consisting entirely of white women who were ashamed of the conditions there, successfully campaigned for these basic improvements. While my mother and Major Kinner and their 2 children were living in Kingar, residents had to hand-pump their own water from a nearby well. The only bathrooms were outhouses. To help sustain themselves, many residents grew their own food in gardens outside of their homes and kept hogs and chickens. There was only 1 store in the community, run by a merchant who did not live there. Though Jim Crow was not codified in the North, segregation remained a persistent reality. My mother was well-liked by people in Kingar. They knew her as a person of warm smiles and big hugs. But she also seemed intent on moving her family away as soon as she could. The quality of her life was worse than in South Carolina. Her days were consumed with the business of caring for her family as Major Kinner worked on construction teams. The Methodist and Baptist churches were the center of social life in Kingar, but Willie Mae was not a church-going person. She was skeptical about religious faith at a time when many black women considered faith a central focus of their lives. Willie Mae preferred playing cards and telling jokes. While at home in Kingar, she began to spend time with O.W. Allen. No one gave them much trouble for it. It was interesting back then that in this community a lot of people were married to one person, but they were living with another person, and they all got along, says Karen Jackson, who now runs the Civic Association in Kingar. A bond grew between O.W. and Willie Mae, despite her junior college degree and his 3rd-grade education. They both liked to tell stories and had boisterous laughs. They both kept gardens and loved growing food. O.W. also saw in Willie Mae a solution to some of his shortcomings. "She had beautiful handwriting," says Ray Kenner, my mother's youngest son by major. That meant a lot to him. "Willie Mae was a beautiful, smart, intelligent woman," says Marshall Stewart, who lived in Kengar and knew both of my parents. O.W. was an upstanding, upright walking man. Stewart used to set off every weekend with O.W. to go hunting in a nearby forest called Sandy Spring, or fishing in the Potomac River for catfish.